Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing Academy Award-winning film Apocalypse Now and Academy Award-winning actor Dustin Hoffman. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We're here.
Here and now.
Somewhere in a deep and dark jungle. Talking about this deep and dark film.
Oh, brother.
What a film it is.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
We'll get into that. And Dustin Hoffman.
Yes. Yeah. We are talking about some weird stuff today.
You know, classic Hollywood 70s
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it's 70s Hollywood. What can we say?
But before we get too deep into it, I think Bosley has a review for us.
He does, in fact. Bosley has quite a lot to share with you today. Well, not a lot to share, but he has some exciting stuff to share with you.
Oh, great. And if you don't know, Bosley is one of our pups, named after famed New York Times film critic Bosley Crowther. And so our pup Bosley, like reviewer Bosley Crowther, gives reviews.
But he, being a dog, of course, only reviews dogs' performances.
And sometimes other animals.
Sometimes other animals, his peers. And so today, Bosley wanted to take a couple-year peek back in history to the 1972 film Sounder.
Oh.
Academy Award-nominated film. Multiple nominations. The first film in Oscar history to have two Black actors nominated at the same time for Best Actor and Best Actress, of course, being Paul Winfield and Cicely Tyson.
Nice.
And lots of other great achievements as a film, of course. But Bosley is focused in on our dog. So, of course, the movie is called Sounder, which is the name of the dog in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about this dog. But if you aren't familiar with this story or didn't read this as a kid, it's a book first. Mm-hmm. And the book is very much about the dog and the boy and then their parents, or the boy's parents. And this movie is very focused on the family. And the dog is a very minor character. It's mostly just like a vehicle to talk about the family's struggles, talk about the father's struggles and the son's struggles and stuff like that. The mom's struggles too. So Bosley was very proud of Swampy, who played Sounder.
Swampy.
Swampy has an IMDb credit, but I am sad to say there is no other information about Swampy. I even read someone's like PhD thesis thing trying to find some info about Swampy. Everybody's apparently too interested with the people and the dynamics of this movie to really give us much information about Swampy. Oh. But what we do know is that he is a red-bone coonhound and bulldog mix.
Oh.
And he's kind of old in the movie. He's not like a young pup. He's kind of like middle age. And he gives a great performance as a boy's best friend. And Bosley just wanted to point out some of this film's achievements that Swampy did contribute to.
Uh-huh.
As mentioned earlier, both Paul Winfield and Cicely Tyson are nominated for Best Actor and Best Actress. And having two Black actors nominated in these prominent roles, not supporting the Best Actor-Actress, isn't going to be achieved again until 1993 for the film What's Love Got to Do with It. Hmm. And then the third film to achieve this is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in 2020.
Yeah.
So Bosley was very disappointed in the Academy for that.
Wow.
Yes. Also, this film is worth noting because Lauren Elder III became the first African-American and person of color to be nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Wow.
Which
nice.
Was pretty remarkable as well, which Bosley was very proud of as well.
All due to Swampy.
Thank you, Swampy, for your participation in this film. And Bosley gives Swampy's contributions and performance and such. Three howls.
Oh, three howls.
Yeah, for Sounder, who is known for his barks.
Yeah.
And then not barking. And then when things turn around, barking again.
Indeed. Well, good job, Bosley.
And with that, we pass it off to you to talk about the film Apocalypse Now, which I'm a little bit nervous to hear about.
So, of course, we're talking about the year 1979. We just covered the 52nd Academy Awards. And I was going through the other films, you know, I'm always trying to decide what other film can I talk about. There were some big films this year, All That Jazz.
Right. I was wondering if you would talk about that, but
nominated for Best Picture, Apocalypse Now, nominated for Best Picture, and Alien.
I thought you were going to do Alien. I was kind of hoping.
So it was a little bit of a toss up, but I landed on Apocalypse Now.
You got to do it.
It's just too good.
It's film history fodder. Like, it's so essential to film lore, Hollywood lore. If you want to be a person that is a film person, you got to know some lore about Apocalypse Now.
It's true. So I will be talking about Apocalypse Now. I will give a shout out right off the bat to the podcast What Went Wrong.
That is true. Yes. I've heard that episode.
They have a really amazing episode on Apocalypse Now, and their whole thing is like the things that went wrong. So, and you know, we're talking about just the making of the film in general. So if you want to hear even more horror stories and craziness about this film, go check out their episode.
Yes, it is full of humor and lots of interesting stuff.
Or just check out their podcast in general. It's great. So on to Apocalypse Now, starting with a recap. Not nearly as long as the film.
Nothing is.
During the Vietnam War, Colonel Kurtz has gone reportedly insane, exercising methods and brutalities that were never approved by his commanding officers. Captain Willard is given a secret mission to travel up the river, find his location, and kill him, thus stopping his terrible activities. Willard joins a patrol boat with Phillips, Chef, Lance, and Mr. Clean as they traverse the river looking for Kurtz. They come upon the different horrors of the war, and Mr. Clean and Phillips are both tragically killed along the way. Finally, they discover Kurtz's new location, living amongst a tribal group that he has convinced he is a god. Kurtz tries to persuade Willard to join in his cult, killing Chef as a fear tactic, but Willard is resolved. During a ceremonial ritual, while everyone else is distracted, he gets Kurtz alone and kills him. Finally, the deed is done, and Willard and Lance flee the area back down the river.
Yeah, that's good. That's about it.
Yeah. This film ended up having a budget of $31 million, which is way more than was intended. And it grossed somewhere between $100 to $150 million, which is a pretty big discrepancy, but it's kind of hard to know exactly how much it ended up making. But it ended up being number four at the box office in 1979, which was pretty impressive. Behind, of course, number one, Kramer versus Kramer, which we just talked about. Mm-hmm. The Amityville Horror.
Oh, my. Wow.
Which was number two.
Okay.
Rocky II.
Uh-huh.
Also produced by United Artists, and Apocalypse Now.
All right. How is a lot of your information today coming from The Heart of Darkness, or?
Yeah, so there's some information coming from that. Also a great reference. If you have not seen that and you want to know more about this film, Coppola's wife, Eleanor Coppola, was making a... She was there to direct promotional material for United Artists, which a lot of it they didn't end up using. And then everyone sort of was going crazy, and so they didn't want to use it. But they held on to it for a while, and finally she produced it as a documentary, which came out, I think, in like 91.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these stories are from that, and some are from other places I've researched.
Gotcha. For the record, people, I tried to watch this, but apparently somebody rented it, and then it expired before I got to watch it, so I didn't get to see it.
Well,
so this is all new to me.
Great. So the story of this film is a loose adaptation of the Joseph Conrad novella, Heart of Darkness. And of course, that's where the documentary gets its name. It's called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse.
All right.
So in the film lore of Hollywood, this story was considered one of the like unadaptable stories up to this point in history in Hollywood, with several filmmakers trying to make a pass at it over the years, most notably Orson Welles, who was never able to make it. He did, however, do a radio production of it before he made the jump to Hollywood and had planned it as his first film, but because he couldn't get that idea fully formed, he ended up making Citizen Kane.
Ah.
So, of course, this idea came to John Milius, who was in a screenwriting class at USC, whose professor offered this as a challenge to his students.
Oh, gosh.
Saying, quote, "No screenwriter has ever perfected a film adaptation of Joseph Conrad's Hearts of Darkness."
Oh, wow. Why did that stand out to him?
I don't know. But of course, as a young film student, you hear that and
you're
think,
like, I'm going to do it.
Well, I'm the one that's going to make the best film of it. Orson Welles couldn't even do it. So at the time, Milius was working with Coppola as an assistant on the film The Rain People. George Lucas was also an assistant of Coppola's at the time, and Steven Spielberg was quickly becoming a close friend of all of theirs. We've been talking about these men a lot.
This is the gang we're with right now.
Yeah, the new Hollywood gang. And Milius was very eager to write and make a film about the Vietnam War. He was kind of war crazed. He really wanted to join the army and go to war. And a bunch of his friends did as well. But then he ended up being rejected because he had asthma.
Ah, same man. It's okay.
So he was pretty disappointed that he couldn't go to war.
Wow,
so
what
he
a
decided
shame.
To make this film or write this film at least.
I just don't understand that sentiment, but that's okay.
Yeah. So he began writing an adaptation of Heart of Darkness. And he more so wanted to capture like the motifs of the film and sort of like the story as an allegory.
Okay.
Rather than making an adaptation of the story.
Gotcha.
So this the real story in the novel is about somebody who goes up the river in the Congo to find somebody, Colonel Kurtz, same names, but who's doing some terrible humanity things, but has nothing to do with Vietnam at all.
Oh, it's just its own story. So they're setting it in the Vietnam War because that's what's relevant. Okay,
correct.
Got it.
But that's like the only thing about the story that's the same. So he also decided to set it during the Vietnam War because he thought that if he wrote it and it was good, they could go to Vietnam and film it during the war. And all his friends who are there in the war could be in it.
That is such a film student mentality.
Yeah.
Of like, oh my God, you're going to be there? Oh, perfect. You could just be like background for this one scene I'm doing. Oh my word. That makes me cringe.
Yeah. Don't you want to just like go over there and he wanted George Lucas to go and direct it.
How do you tell your friend, dude, get it together?
So Coppola heard that Milius was writing the script and ended up deciding to offer him $15,000 from his newly formed company, American Zoetrope. Plus, he promised another $10,000 if a film was actually produced. Coppola was interested in this being the first film with the company, so Lucas began operating as if he would direct it, and then started helping with the treatment of the story and even wrote his own version of the script as well. Milius began incorporating stories from his friends who were on the front lines, and Coppola told him to, quote, write every scene you ever wanted to go into that movie, which led Milius to writing up to 10 drafts of the screenplay and over 1,000 pages of material for the film.
Oh my gosh. What? No. Kill your darlings.
Eventually, Warner Brothers Seven Arts acquired the screenplay in 1969. This is during the 2 years that they're called Warner Brothers Seven Arts.
Okay.
Before Gulf and Western buy them. They decided to put it in turnaround, and so it got stuck in development there. Meanwhile, Lucas continued to work with Milius on plans to make the film, and they collaborated for almost 4 years while he began work on his own films, American Graffiti and Star Wars. Lucas's friend and producing partner, Gary Kurtz, began scouting locations in the Philippines for the film to start shooting in 1971 on location in the Philippines, and then also using rice fields that were around Sacramento in California.
Oh, okay.
Eventually, prospective producers for Lucas's other films caused him to put this one on hold. So this film went away while he made his other films. After another year or two, Coppola went back to Milius's script. He was looking for new material, and decided to reread it. And then he found that Warner Brothers had let the option run out, so he repurchased it so that he had the rights to the script. He was set to produce with his friends Fred Roos and Gary Fredrickson, offering the director role to both Milius and George Lucas, but both were too busy, and Star Wars had just been greenlit. So
gotta do Star Wars.
He decided to do Star Wars instead.
I think that was a good call.
So Coppola decided that he would try to direct it himself. Of course, as we've mentioned throughout the other films that we've talked about of his, he really wants to be just a producer. but somehow he keeps getting wrapped up in directing as well. But he does like directing, so...
Yeah, and obviously he's good at it.
Yeah.
To some degree.
but he grew more and more excited about the project, saying he was eager to take the audience, quote, through an unprecedented experience of war and have them react as much as those who had gone through the war.
Had he seen The Deer Hunter yet?
No.
Oh.
It had not come out.
Ah, got it. Okay.
So no Vietnam War film has come out at this point. So everyone's racing to be the first to make it.
Okay. I understand now.
The Deer Hunter was able to get there first.
Okay, gotcha, gotcha.
And then there was one or two other like lower budget films that came out between The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now.
Gotcha.
But it's still within the first like handful of films.
Yeah, well, and it is a very sweeping film. Like it's got a lot in it that you... It's just shocking.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it. I mean, maybe you'll tell us.
So he ended up scouting locations in Florida, Georgia, and Australia, wary of filming anywhere near Vietnam.
As he should be.
But all of those plans fell through, and the United States Army was not wanting to participate.
Mm.
So they would have been participants if they had been able to film in Florida or Georgia. Fred Roos had connections to the Philippines from two previous films he'd made there, and they decided to try to connect with the Philippines president, Ferdinand Marcos, who is more of a dictator, but was called a president, who offered their American-made military equipment and some funding from the government for the film.
Oh, good. Oh, that makes me feel real good.
So Coppola secured the rest of the funding, which was $7.5 million from United Artists and another $8 million from international investors who were promised that the film would star Marlon Brando, Steve McQueen, and Gene Hackman.
Uh-oh.
Though Coppola had gone through many pains with Marlon Brando on both The Godfathers 1 and 2, go listen to those episodes if you want to hear about that. including Marlon Brando just deciding not to show up for the one day of filming he was supposed to show up for.
Yeah, at this point, he's a nuisance.
Godfather Part 2. He decided to reach out to him about Apocalypse Now.
Why? Why do you do this to yourself?
And Brando agreed to work on the film on the grounds that he'd be paid $1 million signing bonus. Just to start out. Then he would make $1 million per week that he would be needed for filming. Plus, he would make 10% of the gross of the film.
10%? That's unreasonable.
Which Coppola agreed to.
No, dude!
He also ended up getting 10% of the sale for the TV rights as well.
Oh my gosh.
Which is crazy.
Wow.
Though apparently Coppola did offer the role both to Orson Welles.
Oh my gosh.
And to Lee Marvin.
What a time it could have been.
Yeah, two very different actors, wow. Both of whom turned it down, apparently.
Okay.
So then Steve McQueen asked for $3 million to be in the film. So since he was already paying Brando so much money, he was like, I can't also pay Steve McQueen $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at the start, his budget was only like close to $15 million.
It's like a third of my budget's going to be actors.
Yeah. And Steve McQueen did not want to sign up for the 16-week shooting schedule in the Philippines.
Hmm.
So he was released from the film, and then Coppola ended up losing $5 million from investors after he told them that McQueen was not going to be in it.
Oh, man.
Harvey Keitel ended up being cast instead as Willard, which was sort of based on his performance in Scorsese's recent film, Mean Streets.
Mm.
Then Gene Hackman was meant to play Kilgore, But couldn't do it for some reason. And Robert Duvall ended up getting the part instead.
Oh, I'm going to talk about both of them today. They're all buddies.
And Robert Duvall was...
He's great.
Very good in this film. Yeah. He basically had to do nothing.
Yeah, he just... He was amazing. Existed.
James Caan was offered the role of Colonel Lucas.
I was surprised it wasn't him.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like that was supposed to be him.
Yeah. But he asked for way too much money for the small part.
Yeah, okay.
So Coppola cast Harrison Ford on the suggestion of George Lucas, which is super fun.
Yes. It's
like
a fun surprise.
Great little role for him.
I didn't even know he was in this.
I didn't know. Yeah.
That was like weird. I was like, what? How?
When he met with Brando initially, Brando had gained a lot of weight because he hadn't been acting in a while. And he had not been doing very much with his life.
Or has not been doing very much just in general.
Yeah. He assured Coppola that he would lose the weight by the time he was needed for filming.
Oh, no.
Because he was meant to portray a Green Beret in the middle of the war.
And he's asking for all this money, too.
Yeah, it's like, one thing if, like, you're playing a bit role and, like, they're just like, hey, do this, and then...
Yeah.
But he's getting paid, like, more than any other actor in the film.
Yeah.
Then Sam Bottoms, Lawrence Fishburne, which was crazy that I forgot that he was in this movie, and Albert Hall all signed on to play the other men in the boat on the river journey. And they, including with Harvey Keitel, signed 7-year deals with United Artists and with Coppola.
Oh, my.
To be included in this film.
Wow. I mean, you do want to hitch your wagon to someone you trust. And at this point, Francis Ford Coppola has just had hits.
Yeah.
So why not?
And Lawrence Fishburne was only 16 years old.
Why did his parents let him do that?
I don't know. But it's amazing.
I mean, yeah, it's great.
And of course, definitely he turned out to be the Lawrence Fishburne that we know, because he was amazing in this movie.
Yeah, he was one of the best parts for me.
Yeah, he was so good. So sets began to be created on location with art director Dean Tavularis, I don't know, leading the charge, employing hundreds of locals in building every single set seen in the film.
Oof.
Including the giant temple.
What?
That was built for the film.
What? That's stupid. That's stupid.
And it was built like as you would normally build it. Like
authentically?
Yes. It wasn't built as a set. It was built as
like
a temple.
It's not like painted things.
No.
Oh my gosh.
It's like real mud
made
into bricks and stones and then made into
a
temple.
And then hauled over to make the temple. Oh my gosh.
They were paid anywhere from $1 to $3 a day, which in the documentary, Tavularis says, he's like, we paid them $1 to $3 a day, which is what they asked for, but I hope we weren't taking advantage of them.
Good Lord.
So there's that.
You know what this makes me think of? It makes me think of how people today are like, what people just like aren't willing to like make real movies. Everybody wants CGI. They don't want to go on location. They don't want to
build
sets.
It's because of movies like this.
It's because of this. This nonsense. There is a way to bridge those two worlds, to have practical things and also let artists do their jobs and like make sets for you.
Mm-hmm. So finally, the film began shooting after Coppola moved himself and his entire family to a house he'd rented in the Philippines. It's really funny because like 6-year-old Sofia Coppola is like in the documentary and she's like running around and they're about to shoot a war movie.
Oh my gosh.
So they began the proposed 4-month shoot on March 20th, 1976, with a release date of April 7th, 1977. Which happened to be Francis Ford Coppola's birthday, which is funny.
Hmm.
But after only a week of filming, Coppola decided that he needed to fire Harvey Keitel from the film.
Uh-oh.
So he immediately flew to L.A. and cast Martin Sheen instead.
Oh boy.
They resumed filming again on April 24th. But then on May 26th, the production had to be abandoned because of Typhoon Olga. Which destroyed almost all of the sets. that had been built.
That had been hand-built.
Yes. Stranded many crew members because of destroyed roads and caused around 200 deaths in the Philippines, as well as tons of property damage for locals.
Oh, my gosh.
Many cast and crew members returned to the United States while sets had to be rebuilt for 6 to 8 weeks.
Well, and like, how do you convince people to go back after that?
I don't know.
Like, your crew is probably all gone.
Well, and then, so production began again in July.
Wow. Yeah, I would have just gotten a different job. I wouldn't have stayed on the project.
So then more time is passing, more time is passing. They're filming and filming and filming. And about a year has passed.
Oh, my gosh.
We're all the way to March 5th now, 1977. And Martin Sheen has a heart attack. He's only 36 when he has a heart attack.
Well, they made him go to a war zone.
He ended up crawling out of his room in the middle of the night and was picked up by a local bus and taken to the main production office before being taken to the hospital. And he was actually read his last rites because they thought he was going to die. He ended up then being sent back to the U.S., where he was on bed rest for several weeks until he was well enough to start filming again. So during this time, they had to just like try to come up with anything that they could film. So they ended up filming a lot of the boat sequences twice because they filmed anything that they could film without Martin Sheen.
Oh, yeah.
On the boat during this time. And then once he was back.
Oh my gosh.
He came back and then. They're like, they filmed all his close-ups on the boat.
We're going to film all the scenes with the guy and the puppy.
Yeah. So once Brando was finally brought on set, he was still very overweight. He was apparently over 300 pounds at this point, and nothing could be done about it. So they did a lot of weird things, like they put him in very loose-fitting clothing, much darker clothing than they had planned also. Put him in shadows constantly.
You don't even really see him.
A couple days after he got there, he decided to shave his head without telling anyone.
Oh my gosh.
So that's why his head is shaved in the film.
He looks like a big baby.
He looks really bad in the film.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Like, I mean, but it fits the film.
Luckily, it's so weird that it's like a really high note, I guess, for the film. Like it actually works, but it just is very jarring.
Yeah.
You're like as an audience member, you're like, something is very wrong here.
Also, he's been brought in to film the end of the film and they still don't have an ending of the film.
Oh boy.
So Coppola's been waiting to find it, to receive it from the
universe. You are part of the acting studio, right? Just do your little thing.
He also found out once he got to set that Brando had not read the book and didn't know anything about the story either. So the first week he was in the Philippines, Coppola decided to shut down production for a week so that he and Brando could meet privately to find the character.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Also, if you have all these millions of dollars and there's not like you're not working on your character and like your stuff, what are you doing with your time? He's apparently not doing other work. He's not very social. What is he doing?
I don't know. Wallowing, probably.
Oh, that's sad. Oh, now I feel bad.
I mean, he was definitely very depressed.
Oh, Marlon. Come on, man.
So eventually he and Martin Sheen pretty much improvised almost every scene that they had in the movie together. There's a lot of really crazy clips of them improvising in the documentary.
Oh.
And like Marlon Brando just like going off the rails and saying just insane stuff because he has no idea what's happening.
Oh, wow. Boy.
In one of the scenes, he's like, well, I can't come up with any more dialogue, so I'm done. And in another scene, he like swallows a fly. And there's a clip of him just like saying a line and all of a sudden he's like, oh, I just swallowed a bug. It's so funny. So then eventually they ended up coming up with an ending kind of by happenstance. Eleanor Coppola was out and she happened to hear that they were doing this ritual where they were going to kill a water buffalo and sacrifice it.
Yeah.
And this is just what the local tribe was doing that was involved in the filming. And so she called her husband and
Hey, Francis.
They went and watched this. And then he was like, well, that needs to be what the end of the movie is.
We're decapitating an animal? Hell yeah. Let's do it.
And then he was like, you know, we'll interplay that with Kurtz being sacrificed also as a big water buffalo.
Oh my gosh.
And
what if this was you? Would you be offended if you watched this movie and like, you think I'm a water buffalo?
Well, all right. So this is where there's a lot of controversy because like they filmed an animal being killed to put in the movie.
It's obviously real. It's horrifying. I had my hand in front of my face.
And so basically their way around this was basically like they were doing another ritual sacrifice and like this animal was going to be sacrificed by this tribe.
The tribe was
anyways.
Doing it either way.
Yeah.
I see.
And so they were like, well, would you mind doing it as a part of the movie
and like letting
and
us
doing
film
the
it.
Whole sacrifice and we'll film it as part of the movie.
Did they let them just do it the way they do it?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. They didn't like interrupt
or anything.
So they
didn't change anything. No. And that's why none of the characters are really in that scene.
Right. It does seem very removed from the action of the movie.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then because it was filmed in the Philippines, like any kind of American animal rights activists couldn't really
do anything
stop
about it. Yeah.
Though they did give the film like it was not approved by them, basically.
I mean, his whole filmography is on the blacklist for animal rights activists.
Yeah. So eventually, that's what the ending they decided would be.
Okay.
And that's what it was. And Coppola ended up being so over budget during this whole thing that he ended up having to start auctioning off his personal belongings.
Uh-oh.
And putting up his personal items, including his home and his car, as collateral to United Artists in case the movie was a flop.
Oh my gosh.
So essentially, if the movie failed,
everything's
they
gone.
Would basically own everything of his. And Eleanor Coppola is so, I don't know how to describe her because in the documentary, she's just like, yeah, I mean, whatever he wants to do, like, he's an artist and he's going to be successful. And like, I had no worries that like, we might lose the house and the car and everything, but like, he's going to make his movie and it's going to be great.
She's a gambling woman.
I know.
Wow. I don't know if that's like impressive or scary.
I know. I mean, it's probably why he's been able to be himself for his life.
Like, the love of a good woman.
She's been there to empower him.
Oh, gosh.
For good or bad.
Yeah.
Finally, principal photography ended on May 21st, 1977, with 238 shooting days.
You know what? When we started this conversation and you said it was going to be 4 months, I was like, that is really not that bad. I don't understand why actors wouldn't just commit to that knowing who they're going to work with. Like, the Godfather movies have come out. Mm-hmm. So, like, why would you not want to work with Francis Ford Coppola for 4 months of your year? Now I know why that sounds horrible.
So then, of course, post-production dragged on and on because of the immense amount of footage. Mm-hmm. They shot over 1 million feet of film, which was more than 10 times the length of what an average film would be. Before the film was actually completed, Coppola was invited to screen the film at Cannes, primarily because he had won the Palme d'Or with The Conversation. And it ended up being the first film to ever be screened as a work in progress at the festival.
Wow, interesting.
So it was not a final cut that they showed. And he had to get all of this special approval from all of the guilds and the unions because it was not a complete film and he didn't have credits. So he had to show the film many, many times without credits, which is like without a credit sequence because he just like wasn't prepared to do that. And so he got all of these special like arrangements with all the unions and guilds that he could print out a list of everybody.
I was going to say, have like Eleanor write like a poster board with everybody's names on it.
Yeah. So he got programs printed at a bunch of screenings in LA and at Cannes and a bunch of other screenings, because like for the first like several months that the film screened, there were no credits.
Boy.
Which is weird.
Huh. Of all the things, like that doesn't seem like it'd be that hard to accomplish.
I don't know.
Artist be artist, I guess. Yeah.
When he screened the film at Cannes, he had this famous quote. He said, quote, "Apocalypse Now is not about Vietnam. It is Vietnam. And the way we made it was very much like the way the Americans were in Vietnam. We had access to too much money, too much equipment, and little by little, we went insane."
Hmm. All right.
The last thing I'll share is this quote from Roger Ebert. The critical reception was pretty mixed at the time. A lot of people complained that the film was too long.
It is too long.
The one that we watched is much longer because it's actually Apocalypse Redux.
What do you mean?
It's the next iteration that he released. Like,
oh, it's like a different
20
cut.
Years later. Yeah. Ooh. So he's been working on this film for like 40 some years. So he re-edited it to that, put in a lot of new stuff. Gotcha. The French dinner scene was never in the original version.
Well, it didn't need to be in any version. It was so ridiculous and not relevant.
It was not in the original version because he was so specific about everything. And he said the art direction was so good that the actors looked so bad because they could never live up to how good the art direction and the like the shots were. And
okay,
like,
that's a little rude.
So he decided to scrap that whole sequence from the original cut.
Okay. All right. Well, all right.
And then he ended up releasing the official cut, which is the final cut of the film, only recently, like within the past like 15 years.
Okay.
And he took 20 minutes off of the Redux cut.
Hmm.
And that's technically now, according to him,
the official cut.
Some 40 years after it was
okay.
made.
Okay. All right.
Anyways, Roger Ebert had this
Eleanor
to say.
Never says no.
Quote, "Apocalypse Now achieves greatness not by analyzing our experience in Vietnam, but by recreating in characters and images something of that experience. What's great in the film and what will make it live for many years and speak to many audiences is what Coppola achieves on the levels Truffaut was discussing, the moments of agony and joy in making cinema. Some of those moments occur at the same time. Remember the helicopter assault and its unsettling juxtaposition of horror and exhilaration? Remember the weird beauty of the massed helicopters lifting above the trees in the long shot and the insane power of Wagner's music played loudly during the attack, and you feel what Coppola was getting at. Those moments as common in life as art, when the whole huge grand mystery of the world, so terrible, so beautiful, seems to hang in the balance."
Very poetic.
Yeah, I thought that was a really like apt description of the film.
Yeah, that's a good way to parcel it out, I think.
Because it's a really, really amazing film.
It truly is.
Some of the shots are just so beautiful and
it's unbelievable, to be honest. Like the cinematography
is crazy that it was able to be made.
Yes. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a horrible film. I mean, it shows the horrors of war as good as any other film.
Yes,
does,
I did not like watching it.
Yeah.
It's a very visceral film, and because of the imagery in it, like because of the way it's shot and how beautiful it is, it's also very terrible.
Yeah. So I'll just mention the Academy Awards that it was nominated for. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director for Francis Ford Coppola, Best Actor in a Supporting Role for Robert Duvall, Best Writing, Screenplay based on material from another medium, Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, which it won.
Yes.
Well deserved.
Yes.
For Vittorio Storaro. Best Film Editing and Best Sound, which it won.
Mm.
So that's what I have to say about Apocalypse Now.
All right.
A film that is definitely worth watching, but also, I don't know.
My perspective on it is that if you are a person who really likes film, like film history, that kind of stuff, you have to watch it.
Yeah.
If you are not, you don't have to watch it. It's, you can live your life just fine without it.
If you don't like war movies at all, or even a little bit, don't watch this movie.
Yeah. Some of us are forced to for our podcast. I'm really nervous when we get to the early 2000s and it's like Hurt Locker, all those other Saving Private Ryan, whatever movies that I'm going to have to think and watch. And I'm going to hate my life.
Well, we'll get there someday.
I don't know. I feel like maybe Vietnam's worse, though.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and with that, let's change gears a little bit here and hear some about Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, so I am talking about him today. He's been a very prominent actor over the last, you know, decade that we've been doing the Academy Awards, and he's going to stick around. So I figure it's time to talk about him. I haven't done a lot of actors. I do a lot of actresses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care very much about actors. I think I did James Dean and that's about it. But I figure why not? You know, he's a part of the stuff we talk about. So let's talk about his life and career. So Dustin Hoffman, just some like overview, of course, he has a lot of awards. He's won 2 Academy Awards, 4 BAFTAs, 5 Golden Globes, 2 Emmys. He's also gotten a bunch of honors. He's gotten the Cecil B. DeMille Award, the AFI Life Achievement Award, the Kennedy Center Honors Award, like lots of stuff. He's renowned.
Just like all the other people you've talked about.
Absolutely. they all are at least Oscar winners. So, oh, I talked about Sidney Poitier as well. Another actor I did talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways. He was born August 8th, 1937 in Los Angeles. His father was a prop supervisor and sort of set decorator at Columbia Pictures.
Oh.
And then eventually became a furniture salesman. But he was already kind of connected to the industry a little bit. He was also named after stage and silent screen actor Dustin Farnham. So like his family's like living in LA. They know the industry. So there's like already kind of a predisposition. He talks a lot about how he was just like a... not theatrical is the wrong word, but he loved to like kind of make people laugh and like be connected in that way. One of the things he talks about as a kid was that this is like from one of his interviews he was talking about at dinners for several days following a family fight, his father, mother, grandmother, and his, as he says, handsome, high achieving brother would sit silently after the fight. And then suddenly he would just like jump up and start repeating the dialogue of the fight, taking all the parts and playing all of them.
Oh, my.
And then they would start to laugh and the tension would go away. He said, quote, I never thought about acting, but it was a great feeling to break the collective anger in the room. I mattered. I had an identity in the house.
Hmm.
So that's kind of like where this all comes from for him. He finished high school in Los Angeles, and he enrolled at Santa Monica College to study medicine, but he ended up just leaving right away to become an actor. He studied at the Pasadena Playhouse. When he went there, his Aunt Pearl said, quote, you can't be an actor. You're not good looking enough. And this is the start of a very long tradition of people bashing his looks. And it's something that I want to talk about a little bit just because I feel like actors... we don't let them deal with this as much. We know how the pressure is on women. We talk about it a lot, especially now. But it was something that he was simultaneously very insecure about, but also like navigating with pride because he loved being an actor. And he knew he wasn't a leading man and like wasn't trying to be a leading man. He was trying to carve a way out for himself and had to be a little bit self-deprecating in order to do that. If you just Google Dustin Hoffman interviews or anything like that, there are just like all of these reviews of all of these critics across the board throughout the years saying terrible things about his looks. So you can like have your pick of quotes. But this one I thought was somewhat egregious. It's from Life magazine talking about him. The title of this article is A Swarthy Pinocchio Makes a Wooden Roll Real.
Oh my.
This is the opening paragraph. If Dustin Hoffman's face were his fortune, he'd be committed to a life of poverty. With a schnoz that looks like a directional sign, skittish black beady eyes, and a raggedy hair cap, he stands at a slight 5'6", weighs a mere 134 pounds, and slouches like a puppet dangling from string. All in all, he resembles a swarthy Pinocchio.
Boy.
And then they go on to talk about his acting and how great he is. And it's like, It's very anti-Semitic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's also very aggressive and it's very unkind.
Yeah.
And like, I found so many articles like that. So I felt like that was something worth bringing up. This started at a very young age for him. It's something he always dealt with. And it's something he did embrace for roles like Rizzo and stuff like that. Like where he was like, you know what? If this is what I can do, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, moving right along. His first acting role was at the Pasadena Playhouse alongside future Academy Award winner Gene Hackman. So they meet here. Gene Hackman is 27 when they meet. He describes himself as a big lummox kind of person. And he was really struggling to connect with people in L.A. because he saw everybody else walking around. He called them all tanned and walking surfboards and like very like polished Malibu Barbie types, that kind of thing. But he found Dustin Hoffman and thought he was another misfit like him. And they both gravitated towards each other. They both like had kind of weird looks. They both were gritty actors. They both like had enough of everything. They had a chip on their shoulder, that kind of thing. And Gene Hackman just saw something in him. He said, quote, there was something about him that he had a secret. You just knew he was going to do something. And they both kind of just got along great. And so Gene Hackman ended up moving to New York and convinced Dustin to move with him as well against the wishes of his parents. I also thought this was funny. They both were the kind of actors, like student actors, that just rebelled. And so about Gene Hackman, he apparently just like resisted the teacher's approach to acting. At the end of his first semester, he received a grade in his class of 1.4, which the lowest grade up to that point had been a 3.0.
Oh, my.
And so he was dismissed from class, which is why he ended up going to New York. But Dustin Hoffman like really liked that he was like pushing back. That was very attractive to him as a friend and an artist. So
that's funny.
Anyways, Dustin Hoffman moves to New York. He ends up living with Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman and his wife were living in like a very small apartment. He slept on the couch for a little bit. He arrived with like $50, you know, classic actor story. And Gene Hackman goes, hey, my buddy Robert Duvall is looking for a roommate. Why don't you guys get out of my apartment and live like right next door? So the two of them decide that they're going to live together. So throughout the 60s, the three of them are like best buddies. They're collaborators. They love working together. They're artists cut from the same cloth. They're just doing great. Not great, but like they're loving the artist life, you know? Dustin Hoffman decides to study with Lee Strasberg. And of course, he leans really, really hard into the method acting stuff. And, you know, he like definitely is a product of that. And there have been times I'll like share some quotes and stuff about that, that, you know, talk about how maybe it's not always the best, but he definitely was like really into that style and has become one of the people who has sort of risen above some of the method acting tropes, I guess.
Yeah.
Where like, I didn't really realize this about him until we've started talking about him. Like he's not notorious for his antics or something like that. Just some like fun stuff that was kind of going on in their lives. Their apartment was like a hostel for actors. People were just coming and going. Dustin Hoffman was almost a professional pianist when he was like younger, like college age. So that was something he had been kind of toying with, was if he was going to do that. So he would play the piano and they would sing songs from the new Broadway musicals that were coming out, like West Side Story and stuff like that. Actors would go off and have success and then they'd be like, they moved on without us. You know how it goes. Robert Duvall said about this, quote, yeah, those were good years. Not knowing what the future was about. All these friends, very important. Dreaming. That was fun.
Oh, boy.
Which is just love. Okay. About this time, also, Dustin Hoffman like kind of liked this struggle. He felt personally that it was good for him. He said, quote, you don't erase the first 10 years of your life. It stays with you. It's imprinted. You didn't work. Selfishly, I feel, well, I got it in just under the gun, because he was struggling to find this work. And then he like just at the end of that, like 10 years of his first 10 being an actor, he like got started. It was hard for him to find work in New York. He, you know, at the time, for those of you who don't know, like you had to look through Backstage or Showbiz. He had to try to get stuff. And he was struggling
with our magazines.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. They're magazines with like advertisements for plays and roles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he was really struggling because of the descriptions of characters. He just didn't fit any of them to go out for them. He said about this, quote, It would list the parts available and they would say leading man, leading woman, leading juveniles, leading ingenues, character leading men, character ingenues, character juveniles. Basically he was like, none of those were me.
Right. So.
Luckily though, in 1960, he was cast in an off-Broadway production, of the play, A Cook for Mr. General. And then he like kind of continued to do a bunch of plays during this time. He loved the theater. That's like his calling, you know? So from 60 to 66, he did a bunch of stuff. He was, off-Broadway in Harry, Noon, and Night with Joel Grey. He was a part of the 1965 Death of a Salesman that was recorded with Lee J. Cobb, who originated the role.
Right.
He played Bernard in that one. Mm. I'll talk about this later because obviously he does do Death of a Salesman later in his career, and mm-hmm. it's the absolute best part of his career. This is his favorite play. It's like what got him really, really connected with acting. So he just loved it. He also was directing a lot too. He was the assistant director for Grosbard's 1965 off-Broadway production of A View from the Bridge, which starred Robert Duvall and John Voight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he, you know, it all comes around, right? Mm-hmm. It all comes back around. But then finally, in 1966, director Mike Nichols auditions him for the lead role in the Broadway musical The Apple Tree, but he doesn't give him the part because he couldn't sing well enough.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very impressed by him and casts him in his upcoming film, The Graduate.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is his breakout. And I'm not going to go into this because we have a whole episode about it. Great movie, great role, success. His success shocked his friends. They said, quote, "You were the last one I expected to make it."
Uh-oh.
Jeff Lundberg, who was one of his biographers, wrote that, quote, "Newspapers across the country were deluged with thousands of letters from fans who all kind of said that they identified with him in The Graduate." One of the ones said, quote, "I identified with Ben. I thought of him as a spiritual brother. He was confused about his future and about his place in the world, as I am. It's a film one digs rather than understands intellectually."
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is the total vibe of The Graduate.
Well, and what's so right about him with that movie is that he is normal.
Right, exactly. And he's a newcomer. Nobody knows who he is up to this point because he's just New York stage, right? Mm-hmm. And he looks like your buddy. He looks like that guy you know whose parents have money and want him to do something with his life, but he doesn't have the face or the charm or whatever to do anything.
Right.
Perfect. Love
well, and
it.
It's part of what made John Voight so likable in Midnight Cowboy also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he also like recognizes the risk that Mike Nichols took in casting him because they got along great in his earlier auditions. He said about this, quote, "I don't know of another instance of a director at the height of his powers who would take a chance and cast someone like me in that part. It took tremendous courage."
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, you don't want it to be true, but it is kind of true.
Yeah.
But it paid off big time. So after he finishes The Graduate, he turns down a bunch of roles that were offered to him because he just wants to go back to New York and be in theater. So he goes back to Broadway. He is in the musical Jimmy Shine. He plays Jimmy Shine in it. And he won a Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Performance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which I thought he couldn't sing, but there you go.
Mm.
And he considered himself a theater person. He kept telling his buddies, Gene and Bobby, that he wasn't going to be a movie star. He wasn't going to sell out, that good actors are on the stage. And he said, quote, "I'm going to go make this movie. Don't worry. I'll be coming right back." And he actually did.
Mm.
Sadly, though, he was only paid $20,000 for his role in The Graduate. And after everything, he really only came back with $4,000 after taxes, living in LA, expenses, all that kind of stuff. So he actually ended up filing for unemployment benefits after this, which is kind of sad. But he wanted to keep his apartment in New York. He wanted to keep doing that stuff. So that was the sacrifice he decided to make.
Yeah.
He was then shortly after offered the lead in Midnight Cowboy. And he really wanted to do this to prove critics wrong. And we've talked about Midnight Cowboy, obviously, so I don't need to go into the awesome character stuff and the fun relationship stuff that comes out of that movie. You can listen to our episode, Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah.
But just to talk about how he got into this really quickly, he was very frustrated that people were starting to see him as this preppy guy when he was like, "I can do all kinds of stuff. I don't like this. I don't like that people think I can't do this, that I'm only Benjamin Braddock." And so he, John Schlesinger couldn't picture it, but knew him from previous work in New York and was giving him a chance, thought it was worth trying it out. So he agrees to meet him in Times Square, and Dustin Hoffman arrives dressed as a homeless person. He's wearing a dirty raincoat. He slicks his hair back. He's got an unshaven face. And John Schlesinger says, "All right, I can see it. Rizzo." And of course, he gets his second Oscar nomination. The film wins Best Picture. It's, you know, admitted by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry. Huge change in culture happens. All that good stuff that we talk about in that episode.
Yeah.
Shortly after this, in 69, he co-stars with Mia Farrow in the romantic drama John and Mary, which was pretty good timing because she had just done Rosemary's Baby. He had just done The Graduate. Like, it was just like very good timing for publicity. They were both really, really popular. So the movie does really well. They get the cover of Time magazine that says they're the stars of their generation. He gets a British Academy Film Award for this movie. He's also nominated for a Golden Globe as well. Like, it just does well for him. So then he continues just doing stuff. The next movie of note is Lenny, in which he plays Lenny Bruce in 1974. He just found a really big, deep connection with this character. Obviously, this person, if you know Lenny Bruce, the stand-up comedian, he died at the age of 40. And he's obviously known for his like freestyle, critical comedy that like is a little vulgar. It talks about stuff that's real, you know, whatever. He got arrested a bunch of times, all that kind of stuff. And Dustin Hoffman just loved this.
Of course.
He really thought he was going to win an Oscar for this role because it felt very kindred to him. And he had gotten so much praise for the like down and dirty Midnight Cowboy stuff.
And it's a biopic.
The Academy loves a biopic. Film critic Catherine Lowry, though, said that she thought this was mostly because of director Bob Fosse. She said that he, quote, never gave him a chance to go far enough into developing the character. We never understand what, besides the drugs he injected, make him tick like a time bomb. So she was kind of getting at, throughout her review, that he's good.
Yeah.
But the movie doesn't showcase the actor. It's messy.
Yeah.
And also Bob Fosse was going through some stuff at the time. It wasn't like his best work. He was nominated for Best Actor. The film did get 6 nominations for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Actress, Adapted Screenplay, and Cinematography. So it like did okay. It just like wasn't quite the hit or the career boost that he thought it was going to be.
Right.
And just going to keep moving to like the hits here because there's like stuff in between some of these. But the next one I would just want to mention is he does All the President's Men, which is a great movie. We didn't get to talk about it.
No.
And I love this one. And it's like one of the only movies I've seen prior to this podcast. My mom wanted to watch this with me when I was little. It's, of course, about the Watergate scandal. And it came out only 2 years after it happened.
Yeah.
So it was very, very relevant about the journalists. He and Robert Redford play the two journalists in it. And, of course, it's like a very popular movie that has stood the test of time. And then the next thing I want to mention is Marathon Man, which is, again, directed by John Schlesinger. This has Laurence Olivier in it with him. And this is where I want to touch back upon some of the method acting stuff. In order to approach this character who's like a long distance runner, there's like Nazi stuff. It's, you know, blah, blah, blah. In order to put himself in the mindset of this emotional distress this character is going to go through, he didn't sleep for days at a time. He let his body become disheveled and unhealthy. He was like doing all these things to physically alter himself and like get into the role, you know, all these things. Laurence Olivier's very confused about why he's doing this, and very famously he says, quote, "My dear boy, why don't you just try acting?" So yes, and this film, I mean, it is what it is, but there was a lot of like discrepancies about the script and stuff. So it was like kind of a complicated filming experience. Dustin Hoffman did not like the ending. He felt like it wasn't good for him as a Jewish man, and he wanted to kind of change the perspective. And so there was a bunch of clashing about some of that stuff. In this interlude, he does the movie Agatha with Vanessa Redgrave about the days that Agatha Christie was missing, which the Brits really loved. It did really well in England, so that was fun. But then he moves right into Kramer versus Kramer, which is where we are today. And you can listen to our episode about that movie. And I just love his performance in this movie.
He's just really good in it.
I couldn't say enough good things about it. Really great. He wins his first Academy Award for this movie. Unbelievably deserved. It also wins Best Picture, nominations for Best Supporting Actress, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay. And as we talked about, it was just a very personal movie. He was going through his own divorce at the time, you know, just kind of very in tune with the character and the happenstance and all that stuff. So don't need to go into that too much because we have a whole episode about it that you should definitely listen to.
Yeah.
The next thing I want to mention in 1982 is Tootsie.
Oh, yes.
I've never seen Tootsie. I don't know. It looks really offensive to me, but everybody seems to like it. So I guess it's not. I don't know. I can't tell. I am not the person to judge. So when I watch it, I will come back to you all with a report about it. We're going to have to talk about it because it gets 10 nominations. So we'll get there. It's his fifth acting nomination.
Yeah.
And he says that this is the movie where he discovered he was a feminist.
Oh, wow.
So I'll let you know in the future how that goes.
Great.
In 84, finally, he stars as Willie Loman in the Broadway revival of Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
He's finally come back to his beloved. He also does the same role in the TV movie, which he wins the Emmy for, which I've actually seen, and I really like that one.
Yeah, it is good.
It's just nice. Funny enough, too, he got lucky enough to coincidentally become neighbors with Arthur Miller in Connecticut.
Oh, my.
And so he got to talk a lot about the play with him, and he had just, like, been obsessed with it his whole life. So it was, like, kind of kismet that they were able to discuss it in length so much, so then the filming was pretty smooth. He also did 3 weeks of rehearsal with Lee J. Cobb, the original Willie Loman, just for his own personal benefit.
Oh, my.
Because he just loved it. He was just a fanboy. The next film he does is considered his worst film, which I gotta mention. Elaine May's Ishtar. With Warren Beatty. Everybody thinks it's really bad, but it's like a cult classic. It's beloved by Quentin Tarantino, so like there's some people who are into that, but it's just generally considered a bad movie. And then that brings us to Rain Man. So we'll talk about this in the future too.
Of course we will.
He worked on this film for 2 years. It got him his second Academy Award. He plays an autistic savant type character. I don't really want to talk about it too much because I haven't seen it yet. And I know there's a lot of controversy around it and his portrayal.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about it.
We're going to talk about it very extensively then. So I don't feel like now's the time. He says that he was 20 when he was 21. He worked at a psychiatric hospital, which he felt like really prepared him for some of the like hospital mental health aspects of the movie. I don't know if that's true or not, because we will see later. But Rain Man ended up winning 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Director. And then I just want to kind of go through some of the rest of his movies. I'm not really going to talk about them. I just want to talk about some of the hits. So he does Family Business with Sean Connery and Matthew Broderick in 89. He does Dick Tracy, Hero, Billy Bathgate with Nicole Kidman in 91. He does Hook in 1991.
Oh, yeah.
A classic.
I forget that he's in that.
Yeah. He's in the movie Outbreak, the movie Sleepers, American Buffalo, Mad City. And then he got his next nomination for Wag the Dog in 1997 with Robert De Niro. And then these are some of my personal mentions that I figure I like them, so I'll just shout them out because they didn't get like Academy recognition. But he's in Finding Neverland in 2004, Meet the Fockers, Stranger Than Fiction, Kung Fu Panda 1 and 2, and Noah Baumbach's The Meyerowitz Stories. And then upcoming, he'll be playing Louis B. Mayer in the comedy Mr. Shaw Goes to Hollywood. And he's also been cast in Francis Ford Coppola's Megapolis.
Yes.
So that's coming up in his career.
And don't forget Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium.
I almost said that, but I was like, I don't think anybody likes that.
It's
do
great.
They?
Yeah.
I didn't see
it. It's like a cult film.
Yeah. I remember I was, this sounds so stupid, but I was kind of scared to see it because Natalie Portman had cut all her hair off for like whatever the one was, V for Vendetta
the
or something.
The fan-ups went and saw it in theaters. Thank you very much.
Well, it was a hit with the fan-ups.
Oh, we were there.
And I, unfortunately, like I want to talk about just his acting career, but you can't just talk about that. You have to talk about the whole person. So I just want to mention also that in 2017, he was accused of sexual misconduct by 8 different people. Most of them are accusations of inappropriate jokes and comments and pressure like as a person in power. So that has to be taken into account as well. His reps have like apologized, but nothing has really come from it at this point. It wasn't that long ago that these accusations were made, so who knows. John Oliver did a segment where he brought it up because he's done movies about sexual misconduct before and like the importance of bringing these things to light. And he really just like was very shut down throughout the conversation. He didn't want to talk about it. And John Oliver was like, dude, you gotta like address this or something. And he just didn't want to. So, you know, it, you have to mention it. Unfortunately, with almost all of these actors, there's something. And part of this too that was kind of disappointing to me in just reading about his life, especially in New York with his buddies, was that they were very sexually voracious people. Like they were, they have lots of quotes and comments that I didn't really want to share about going to acting class and being like, this is the perfect place to meet women because they come up to you and they're these like super hot girls that you would never pull in any other circumstance, and they say, let's do a scene together, and then you rehearse with them and you get to get them and all that kind of stuff, which is super skeevy acting school junk that is traumatizing to all of us. So you know, that's the thing I felt like I had to also tack on here as well.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it's always hard looking back from a modern perspective too on, you know, and I'm sure that's part of why he maybe feels weird about commenting on it.
Yeah.
It's just such a different time and everyone is held to such a different standard. And I know it's hard for a lot of people who've been through the industry for a while in trying to reckon with how they approach their past.
Yeah.
And what they've done and who they may have hurt and what they have done that maybe nobody has called them on,
right,
that they feel responsible for or whatever. I don't know. It's a tricky conversation.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's hard too is there are things that are resolved and things that need to be resolved still. And things that are resolved, when do we let them go and when do we still hold people accountable for them? And if they're not resolved, they do need to be resolved.
Well, and what's also so tricky in the court of public opinion is, unfortunately, things get ranked and like, you know, some people are like, well, that does need to be resolved because it's this bad, or this needs to be resolved because it's that bad, or, well, that's not that bad, so we can move on. You know, who's to say what's the right thing to do or not, but.
And I mean, sorry. That's
the important thing is, you know, I think more so the way that people continue to carry themselves, and I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and also like for the purpose of this podcast, obviously we share our opinions about everything, but also this is like about people's history and the film history and the industry and the politics of the industry. And I'm much more interested in talking about people's career and contributions and highlighting those things. And also like when people have stuff like this in their past, you have to acknowledge it too, and you have to take both and hold them together. So anyways, that's that. Moving on. So in the end, he of course has just made an insurmountable contribution to film history and to film culture. I mean, he's very responsible for films in the 60s and 70s and what they are. I mean, when I think of like the 60s, I think of The Graduate. I think of Midnight Cowboy. And even Kramer versus Kramer in the 70s is such an icon, 79, almost 80s. Like, it's such an iconic genre defining film that is because of him and because of his performance. And he is an actor through and through. He did his training. He did the go to New York with nothing but the clothes on your back thing. Like all of that. He did Lee Strasberg, you know. He bemoaned that he never worked with Elia Kazan.
Don't we all?
Don't we all? Anyways, so that's what I have to share today.
And he's still cooking.
He's still cooking. We'll see where we're at in a year or two.
Maybe someday we'll talk about, what is it called? Megalopolis?
Megopolis, I think, is what it is.
Coppola's next epic failure.
Failure? Don't put that on him.
It's been going pretty bad.
Oh.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But with that, we come to the end of our episode and we give our thanks to the Academy for things relating to the films that we discuss, the people that we talk about. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
Well, with no one in particular in mind, I would like to thank the Academy for supportive spouses.
Oh.
You need one. Otherwise, you go crazy. Huh. I always find it incredibly astounding when artists, whatever your profession is, are married to non-artists. Because I can't imagine what that would be like. Because I feel like a very important tenet of our relationship is the ability to understand and to like support and to be like, yeah, quit your job. Get a new job. It's cool. It's going to be fine.
Well, and she seems to be very artistic. I don't know what all she does
in
her life, but she was obvious. I mean, she was there to film those
she totally gets it.
She's a film person.
And she's clearly an artist in her own right, which I think is really good for artists. I know people are like, you need someone to balance you out. I think you need someone to gas you up.
I mean, she definitely did that. Yeah, sell the house. That doesn't matter.
Is that what you're going to say? In the future to me?
Oh, if you're making the next apocalypse
now.
Oh,
gosh, I'm not. I promise you I'm not.
I mean, his take on the situation, too. Like, he has very interesting quotes about, like, basically, if you're making art, you should be all in, no matter what. And, like, nobody should be surprised that he would put his house up for that. Because, like, in a sort of a prideful way, but also in a real way, he's like, you know, I'm a big movie director.
Yeah.
This is what I do.
And this is going to make it. And if it doesn't make it, then I'm screwed. And I'm not going to get screwed.
Well, but also, like, if I don't make it with this one, someday I'll make another film and I'll make more than most people will ever make in their whole life.
Yeah. And I think for people in the film industry, that's less pride and it's more just resilience. Like, it's steeling yourself up and saying, I believe in myself and I believe that this is what I have to give the world. So I'm going to do it. And I don't need to like be like a normal person and worry about all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I will thank the Academy for confidence.
All right.
The one thing that I think the craziest thing to me about this era of Hollywood, it's now considered new Hollywood.
Yeah.
Is it has the same confidence that Hollywood started with. Where it's a bunch of young people who are just like, we just want to do this crazy old thing.
Yeah.
And we believe that we are the best people to do it.
I love it.
And it's just like so crazy to me and inspiring when you think about these people and like how much confidence they have to do what they're doing. Like Steven Spielberg making Jaws or like George Lucas making Star Wars or Francis Ford Coppola making The Godfathers or making this film. He just like knew he had to do it. And through the process, of course, he is like wants to end everything, including his own life, because he's so distraught. And like, if you watch the documentary, there's several clips in it that Eleanor recorded him without his knowledge.
Oh gosh.
Like audio where he's like, confiding in her, but she was like,
that's such a good wife.
I need to record this because it's going to be so good later. Where it's just like, he's so distraught and he's just like, I don't know what I'm going to do and it's horrible and I might as well just jump off a cliff and blah, 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 blah. And I don't, this whole thing is a piece of garbage. But like, somewhere deep inside of him, he has the confidence to be like, but I know that if I just keep working on this movie, I can do it.
Yeah.
So
love that
for confidence.
Absolutely. I feel like I have to harp back. This isn't my next thanks, but I have to harp back on supportive wives. Not only do they gas you up, they laugh at you when you need it. They don't say, honey, no. Oh, no. What should we do? They say, say that a little louder right here. The other thing I would like to thank today is I would like to thank the Academy for those first 10 years. I loved that Dustin Hoffman acknowledged how important that was to him. I love the idea of that, like, La Vie Boheme, you know, you and your artist friends are trying to make ends meet. You don't know who's going to make it. You're surprised at who does make it. And, you know, in my life, like, I feel like I reflect on this a lot, where it's like right now we lean so hard on our artistic friends because those are the community that we have. They're the people that get it. They're the people that pick you up again. They laugh at you. They tell you, okay, it's fine. You're going to be fine. You can still keep going. Like, one failure isn't the end. And yeah, I just love that. I think we all need that. And you need those years of struggle.
Yeah.
You really do. It forges the person.
My last thanks will go to different acting styles.
Okay.
I just think it's so funny when, like, these crossovers happen with, like, I mean, one of my favorite ones is Vivian Leigh and Marlon Brando, which is the same sort of, like, two worlds colliding of, like, older Hollywood meets new Hollywood and, like, the Laurence Olivier acting with
Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman. Also, like, Orson Welles in some of these movies later in life. I mean, the fact that he's in The Muppets.
Hilarious.
Like, that is also right now in 1979.
Amazing.
And so, like, that is very, very good. It's just so funny to me. And, like, yes, the styles change, but also you can look back and still see good performances. Like,
yeah, good acting, good acting.
Stuff of Vivian Leigh's and be like, yeah, she's a really good actor.
Yeah.
And same with Laurence Olivier.
Right.
And sometimes Orson Welles. But also Dustin Hoffman. And, like, I don't know, you need all of those different styles, especially because there are so many genres of things. But it's nice that they can all, like, work together in harmony in some way.
Yeah. I mean, we're finally at the age where there's, like, the old guard. You know, you have your elders now, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's it.
And that's the end of the show.
All right.
Thanks for being with us through this extra long journey through Apocalypse Now and Dustin Hoffman. And we so appreciate your listenership. And keep on tuning in and let us know what you're thinking. And then join us again next week when we discuss the 53rd Academy Awards and the Best Picture winner, Ordinary People.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and at Thank Academy Pod on Twitter. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platform. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Huizinga. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.